We are fine-tuning finance into finding a new capital.
Ernesto, do you ever feel that we are, what we're discussing is asking the industry, which has wreaked possibly the most havoc on our planet, to itself then generate the solution to save it? You've seen the inside. You've worn the proverbial Armani suit. You've gone through a level of intellectual, spiritual, whatever you call it, evolution. Is there a part of you that looks at this and says it's impossible to change? That we can put as many agreements into place, we can generate as many incentives for the industry to evolve, but at the end of the day, it is rotten and it cannot be cured. Hey, welcome back to Radius of Reason, a show where we discuss the various interconnected problems faced by humanity today and in the future. As always, my name is Andre, and I'm joined by my co-host, Vivan.
And today's guest is Ernesto Van Peborg, who is a writer, entrepreneur, and a regenerative designer.
Our conversation in this episode focuses on if our current form of capitalism can be reformed, and if so, what these changes could even look like. All right, Ernesto, do you think that capitalism in any way, shape, or form can save the world?
Yes, not in this current form. It needs to shift radically. It needs to redesign itself from this extractive, profit-oriented, growth-oriented state into something that understands how life works, what are the patterns and principles that living systems use to create regenerative processes. And if it becomes regenerative, we can call it regenerative capitalism, like John Fullerton calls it. I think it has a chance.
Maybe to take a step back, where do you think the overstep has happened? Where was the moment that our economic system lost touch with the realities of day-to-day life or the limits of our ecosystem?
Well, it goes way back. I think it started with a plow. That's the moment that economics and ecology just separated. There's an incredible story by Daniel Schmachtenberger. When we invented the plow, we had to create the forces to move the plow. So we started hitting an ox, dominating the ox, dominating land. We discovered that we could control land through seeds. We can control nature. And that click out of animistic belief into the control of animals, nature, the feminine, others, divided ecology and economy. And I think that is the first shift in our separation from everything.
Yeah, I think it's
like many years ago.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, you know, we've talked about the meta crisis as a sort of framework for understanding a lot of these problems. And obviously one of the key kind of ideas in the meta crisis is that our problem solving is far too narrow and doesn't take the whole into account. And I think that was that the moment of the invention of the plow was like that big first step in disregarding the whole and just detaching ourselves from the complexity of nature, right? Like losing that respect. And once we did that, well, the unintended consequences, you know, are, you know, there's like an infinite number, right, downstream of that point in time. But maybe let's circle back to, I guess, the kind of the modern day economy, because this is what we want to focus on and look forward to how we can, you know, reattach ourselves to the whole more or less. And so, you know, Andre and I have read through a lot of your writing And I think, you know, we both like a lot of kind of the general principles. We like kind of the end game, but I think kind of the middle of it, the meat of it in terms of like what we do concretely, that can still be, I think, difficult for a lot of people to grasp because these are kind of very complex ideas and sometimes a bit too abstract. So can you give us like a few examples of what a regenerative economy could look like, a few aspects of it at least?
Okay. I think we should put a placeholder in how do you need to approach this from a systemic point of view in order to understand it. I think we need to zoom out and change our minds in order to find ways to systemically design our way through the meta crisis.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to hit the like button and of course, subscribe.
We're always trying to make the show better. So if you have any feedback for how we can improve, please leave us a comment as well.
But let's go to some examples. I'm having Guayaquil Yerba Mate here. Guayaquil is a company that was founded 25 years ago from a friend of mine, Alex Pryor, an Argentine guy that was studying in California. And he had this vision of creating market-driven regeneration. So he thought that every pound of yerba mate sold in the U.S. could create an expansion of rainforest and give jobs to the Aché Guaraní tribes that lived in the rainforest, planting yerba mate, that is an undershade sort of tea that you take in a gourd. And with that market-driven regeneration growth, because it's still an old paradigm company, but the impact it generates, it's restoring the Atlantic rainforest, it's giving jobs to the Aché Guaraní tribes not to migrate to the cities, and the yerba mate is an organic shade produced product that has probably now $200 million sales in the U.S. and it's had an incredible impact in restoring the Mata Atlantic forest. So that would be an example of a regenerative design company.
How do you feel some of these concepts could be introduced to the institutions that have already historically captured the market? I think the example of agriculture is probably a fantastic one because in the United States, we obviously have a tremendous issue with how big ag or big agriculture has captured a lot of our markets. A lot of the crops that are grown are quite destructive to the environment, the amount of water they require to grow soy in parts of the Great Plains in the Midwest. It's not in line with the realities of our ecosystems, as you've described. But there's so much money to be gained from it that is there an approach within this philosophical construct of a regenerative form of production that can start moving established institutions towards this more sustainable approach where you've had the success with the mate that you've described. How do you take that success and convince a massive corporation to adopt something similar? Is it a question of government regulation? Is it a question of some form of activist shareholder? What is the way to inject this line of thought into modern practice?
Very complex. Because the meta crisis is the systemic aggregation of a collection of polycrises, right? And probably we are looking at the problem from a reductionist point of view. I think we're looking at the fires of the polycrisis, but we are not understanding what made the forest flammable in the first place. And I think that is the shift that needs to occur in terms of leadership. If you look at the work of Laura Storm and Jill Hutchins, they speak about regenerative leadership, and regenerative leadership is about changing the minds of those leaders. If we are unable to change the minds of those leaders, I think that the shift will not occur. The shift needs to occur at the level of the possibility of a new paradigm emerging. And there are a number of ways in order to create and navigate that. If you want, we can enter into that. The three horizons of Business Shop is one of them.
Hey, everybody. One last pause to the show to remind you that if you want to support our work, please like this video and subscribe to our channel.
And of course, leave a comment. Let us know if you think the finance industry can be redeemed.
But if we do not shift the minds of the leaders into understanding the interdependence of the system, we are still going to be focusing on putting out small fires of the polycrisis and not understanding how we make the forest resilient to avoid future fires.
When you say leaders, are you just referring to leaders of financial institutions or entrepreneurs or politicians as well?
It's policy and finance, basically. Mm. And we need to create a model that has the incentives, the imagination, the purpose. Again, if we are not able to trigger the systemic view of seeing this not as a collection of fires of the polycrisis, if not an underlying flammable forest, and we create the resilience for that forest, nothing is going to change. So we need to work on the minds of policy, finance, and there is a way to navigate this. And it's emerging probably very slowly in terms of the time we need to shift this, but it's there. The good news is there.
So I've noticed like two problems here. One is like, how do you actually transition to this new system, or at least an intermediary system? But then the other problem is like, what actually needs to be like, what is the actual transformation itself? Right. So maybe let's focus on that first, and then we can get to how do we transition to it.
Okay. Perfect.
And I guess, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is, and you've talked about this as well, but the regulations that need to be implemented, you know, not just in terms of taxation, but I think any other sort of financial regulation, and or even new types of currencies. Like one of your white papers on Nature Finance referenced, you know, the difference between monocapitalism and multicapitalism. So maybe you can speak to that a little bit.
Good. There are a number of policies that are coming into place. The global There are a number of policies that are being put forward into possible compliance. Some of them related to climate mitigation. Mm-hmm. New ones in terms of biodiversity mitigation, like the 30 by 30 agreement, mm-hmm. that we need mm-hmm. to stop the loss of biodiversity by 2030 and probably double the amount of biodiversity by 2050. And this is moved by policy and finance. What we have discovered very recently is that 60% of the GDP of the world depends on biodiversity. There is this paper by the UBS white paper called Bloom or Bust. Mm-hmm. that states that 60% of the GDP of the world depends on biodiversity, that there is a framework that came out in the Kunming-Montreal Agreement to stop the loss of biodiversity by 2030 and increase the amount of biodiversity by 2050, that there are a number of institutions that have signed this agreement. There's 150 financial institutions managing $24 trillion in assets that are banking this. But we don't have, at this point, the monitoring, measuring, and certification methods to value biodiversity. And that is coming into practice very soon.
So it's lacking a technology component.
It's lacking the holistic way to measure biodiversity. Mm. We are very good at a reductionist approach. And with CO2, that is very simple. Mm-hmm. You have a hectare that captures 20 tons of CO2. You put a price on CO2 and you issue a carbon credit. But how do you measure biodiversity? How do you measure the interdependence between different flora and fauna, the richness of the soil, the humidity and evapotranspiration of the trees into flying rivers, the combination between flowers and pollinators, the birds eating the insects that reduce the necessity of putting pesticides. Mm-hmm. This is a very complex system that, again, our linear cause-effect minds are unable to understand it and therefore measure it. So the shift has to come from, again, from that perspective. How do we design ourselves to incorporate into our thinking systems thinking, system design, living system design, complexity theory, the exponentiality of times, in order for our minds to have this holistic, regenerative approach to design what needs to be designed? Is this too theoretical?
No, it makes sense. I think, you know, I think both what you and Andre said are correct. Like it is, you know, I mean, it's not just a technological component, but it is missing a technological component. And I think one of the components that is, you know, maybe necessary but not sufficient is like satellite monitoring.
Yeah.
Of you know, different regions on the planet, and then using machine learning algorithms or AI to determine kind of what, you know, what kind of patterns are emerging in different areas. And, you know, I think to try to create some sort of, I guess, you know, it's difficult. It's so complex that you almost need a sort of AI to help you understand how all these interactions are happening, right? Like the mathematics behind those interdependencies that you mentioned between the flowers and pollinators and then the soil richness and so on and so forth, like that, you know, I've taken a decent amount of math in my life. And I think, yeah, we are, that is almost beyond the grasp of human capability without supplementation of some sort of new technology. So maybe is there a way to simplify that into not a final solution? Like Daniel Schmachtenberger talks about, it's a great quote. It's such a badass quote. It's the Tao that is spoken is not the eternal Tao. And the way that would kind of translate into what we're talking about now is the solution that you can name, by virtue of naming it, cannot be the solution, because to put it into words is to reduce its essence, right? In ways that, you know, are relevant.
Yeah. Okay. Let's open that rabbit hole. Because if you understand exponentiality and generative AI agents, Mo Gawdat, the director of business of Google, says that AI will be a billion times more intelligent than humans in the next decade. I think the year is 2037. So, and I think he states that GPT-4 is 10 times more intelligent than 3. So we've moved completely away from the Moore's curve. And the introduction of AI agents will enable us to manage enormous amount of quantum data. You cannot measure biodiversity from a satellite. You can measure foliage, density of trees, colors of probably different leaves, identify different species. But you cannot understand the interdependency of those trees at the level of the roots for healthy soil. So you probably need eDNA. You need very bioacoustic sensors, which already exist. AgTech has created those. So we'll be able to upload enormous amount of data of interdependencies and relationships between different species into AI agents. And I think very soon, probably in the next decade, we'll be able to replicate underlying ecosystems in order to understand what interventions are needed or what resiliency is needed in order to manage those ecosystems. And probably we'll be able to create digital twins for everything. Levon, in a couple of years, I'm going to be speaking to Levon, and it's going to be a digital twin of Levon.
With all the data of his biometrics imported into it. But okay, so, and here we start running up against, I think, one of the central issues that every episode inevitably runs into, is that the solutions that we're prescribing for the crisis that we've created themselves will exacerbate the same crisis we've created. Because the amount of compute power that's going to be required to analyze that sort of data at scale is, I mean, already the strains put on our current electrical grids by the elementary Gen AI functions that we've brought into the market in the past year. I mean, it's already putting even like the G7 economies into quite a difficult circumstance in effective power provision. When you also take into account, you know, the data center electricity usage, the increased usage of charging stations by electrical vehicles, we have to develop that kind of electrical output somewhere. And that's going to be just as caustic and destructive to the environment as all of the other factors that are coming into play that we're trying to study with this lens of biodiversity and measuring impact.
And not to mention the misuse of AI in terms of disinformation, authoritarianism, and so on and so forth. Like, I mean, you couple AI with the satellite imagery that gets better and better, and now you have a truly like dystopian surveillance state that would never have been possible before, but now it might be trivial. Right. And yeah. So, I mean, since this is a very meta crisis themed show now, I think it's interesting because it just shows you the complexity of the problem. Right. Like pretty much any solution that you propose has all these unintended consequences. So maybe we take a step back and ask you, how do you given that piece of information, how do you go about making any sort of decision to do, like, to try to figure out what to do next?
It's a good question. I think it goes back to at the bottom of the soul of this meta crisis, there is an intra crisis. Jonathan Rosen says it's within and beyond, right? And within, there is a this crisis of separation that I was talking about. If you are able to connect and understand how life thrives and how you can design processes, regenerative processes, and you're truly connected with that innate nature that we have, I think we will be able to navigate the complexity of the meta crisis. If we are not able to treat our own inter crisis, there's no solution. I think that is the first step. There's a beautiful video by Joanna Macy of the Shambhala Warriors where she says that this is a man-made and mind-made. Our predicament was created by man and mind, and therefore it can be solved, redesigned by the mind. And I think if we have those tools, the eight principles of regenerative economics of John Fullerton, the seven principles of regenerative design of Bill Reed and Carol Sanford, the way to understand how to design regenerative cultures by Daniel Christian Ward, there is a path there where we can develop capacity of understanding, we can develop sense-making, and we can develop then the capabilities in order to create this third attractor that Daniel Schmachtenberger talks about, or the great simplification, which that Nate Higgins talks about. The great simplification, I think we are beyond that. I don't think we can simplify complexity. But I want to go back to something that you mentioned, is that the enormous energy power needed to move what we were talking about, these digital twins and agents, I think it's in the challenge of AI to solve that.
It's the challenge of AI to solve the problems that AI will bring about.
Because if not, AI will die. If this is only a carbon pulse, as Nate Hagen says, and we're running out of fossil fuels, and everything that we need to build is based on the assumption that we can keep on extracting fossil fuels, or even solar energy that needs the panels which fossil fuel uses to build, I think there's going to be such a disruption in terms of AI helping us to solve probably photosynthesis. We are running into such an uncharted territory. Think about this for a moment. If AI is a billion times smarter than us, that means that Levon is a billion times smarter than a cell that you have on your shoulder, Andre. That's the difference in intelligence.
Yeah, I don't feel very smart still. Yeah.
you're very flattering, Ernesto. Yeah.
So I read last week that the next ChatGPT that they're developing for next year is going to be 100 times smarter than the current one. And we don't have the information to upload there. So it's going to run short of information in the internet, but we are developing that with our chat boxes. And it probably we won't have the energy to run it in a couple of years. And I think, again, the responsibility of AI to become sentient to this problem in order to solve it.
You know what? I think this conversation right now is demonstrating is the fact that you have to do multiple things in parallel, right? Because it might be true what you're saying, Ernesto, that we need the help of artificial intelligence to properly understand the complexity and help us design, you know, the right solutions to these problems, such as, you know, the loss of biodiversity. But if you don't couple that with a proper political movement and the education at a personal level and the redesigning of cities so that people form communities and aren't isolated and all these interdependent things, then you might end up with, you know, a dystopian scenario where you've got a few elites that control AI and everyone else is impoverished. And, you know, they have, you know, their underground bunkers, they have their above ground, you know, Elysium-esque, you know, utopias, and everyone else, you know, is living a shit life. So I think, you know, for the purposes of the conversation, you know, we have to narrow things down just to make sense of things. But I think, I mean, would you agree that you're assuming there has to be things done in parallel here, right? When it not just in terms of, you know, economics, not just in terms of advancing AI, but also, you know, politics, education, and so on and so forth.
Yes. That is attending. If we look at, zoom out from the meta crisis and we see it as a system of interconnecting nodes or polycrises, we start understanding the feedback loops and what the levers are in order to start steering interventions. And we need to attend all those polycrises, but there are some levers that have positive feedback loops in the whole system. So what are the multipolar traps that we can identify in order to start unlocking those multipolar traps that have second and third order effects in the whole system? What are the levers at the level of policy and finance? And probably finance is the easiest one. Because if we can change the flow of finance in terms of generating regenerative flows, I think there you have you're opening the dams of a whole system in order to trigger changes.
But here's to change that, to solve that, I mean, you need to solve other multipolar traps. And I think inevitably a lot of these conversations lead back to we need international coordination. Yes. That was one of the reasons why one of our first episodes on the meta crisis was, how do you create like a third attractor system for international coordination, right? In the spirit of the third attractor.
And in the context of just the gridlock of competition and sort of zero-sum games that are played out between both nation states and corporations, where it seems like the first step is identifying a way in which this sort of change of heart or change of mind is adopted universally. Because if it's not taken on universally, then you start running into the issue of, oh, well, you know, somebody still has a competitive advantage because they're willing to, you know, sacrifice the environment for the sake of generating profit. So in your mind, how do you bring about a change in, I don't even know if it's thought or like existential motivation within something like the finance industry? And sorry, just for a quick caveat, off the off microphone when we first met, you talked about that you yourself went through some sort of internal evolution of thought or kind of a shift in manner by which you perceive your work and your impact on the planet. How can that be replicated at scale for an entire industry with the complexities of a global reach? And I realize we're not asking like very easy questions here, but.
Look, but I could be an exhibit A that change is possible.
Okay.
If you look, if Google me, there's photos of me after Harvard MBA working in Citicorp Venture Capital in New York with suspenders of bulls and bears and Armani suit and a power tie. And I have 20 years of private equity experience. I used to manage very smart money in the first fund, the Goldman Sachs Partners Fund, was the first investor we had. That is probably the smartest money in the world, the Partners Fund of Goldman Sachs, speaking about 20 years ago. That took me into a huge crisis. We can double click on that if you want. But the fact that an investment banker that worked in Wall Street with a Harvard MBA is speaking about a shift in mind towards attending an intra-crisis where we need to develop a new language, more aligned with compassion and love, I think that is the possibility that people change. And I think this shift is going to occur very rapidly because there's a second generation of Ernestos, younger, probably on your age rank, that at the darkest hour that we're going to see very soon, my perception is we are not going to collapse globally. There are going to be a number of collapses. If you're not seeing them now, just look at the NASA pictures of September 9th on the burning Amazon, just turning into a savanna. The floods in south of Brazil 2 months earlier. Collapse is occurring in a disaggregate way. And I think what is happening is that we are very rapidly becoming aware of this. And there's going to be a shift in consciousness and a shift in pressure in those policies. What I'm saying that 196 countries signed an agreement at the end of 2022 in Montreal to stop the loss of biodiversity and increase or double the amount of biodiversity in the world is something that is an incredible disruption, which we don't have I think we have the will. We don't have the aggregate will in order to solve this. And I think in the moment that and we can start speaking about governance if you want, because the technology of governance of commons is there to solve this. All the solutions are out there. What is lacking is this aggregate will. I had I think it's a blessing of sitting in a train with Eleanor Ostrom in 2010 for a 4-hour trip. Eleanor Ostrom received the Nobel laureate the year before, 2009. She wasn't an economist, and she received the laureate in the Nobel Prize in Economy. She solved the tragedy of the commons and created systems for governance to solve the tragedy of the commons. And we are in a tragedy of the commons right now.
Can you tell us what those systems are?
What the solution was? Yeah.
Well, it's a set of rules that she identified by analyzing over 200 commons around the world, resources that were managed by individuals where the priority was to prioritize the health of the resource over the individual benefits. And by doing that, the health of the resource grew or was sustainable, and that benefited the individuals. It's a shift in perception.
But that looks different, right, in different areas? So, like, maybe that, you know, like, that solution implemented at the scale of, like, a small tribe or a small community in the mountains of Bolivia is different than at the scale of like the United States, where you have to really introduce like almost new feedback loops to counter the growth and the growth imperative that all these institutions have, which would, you know, include things like maybe taxation. But also, obviously, you need to add other things like different rules and regulations. I had so many questions. I feel like it's just piling up. So I'm trying to like filter through in my mind. What I said so far, does that make sense?
It makes sense. Again, there is going to be a shift in minds. Eo Wilson says we have primitive minds, medieval institutions, and godlike technologies. And I think Daniel Schwarzenberger also says that the shift is needed at the primitive minds. And so, that is happening. It's a question of fine-tuning, yeah. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you gave yourself as an example, Exhibit A, of this kind of transformation that occurred. But I don't think we can rely on, like, we can't hope that individuals will enlighten themselves.
Like, and we're certainly not seeing it. Like they're not teaching this at the Harvard MBA, from what I understand. Like, this isn't something that is a part of the, and I don't know how much a Harvard MBA feeds into one's, like, individual philosophy when it comes to work, right? Like, it's... We'll leave critiques or comments on that institution aside. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, like, this isn't, if we look at, and I'm cringing on the inside, but if we look at the MBA as the training one receives before they enter into the world of finance, I'm not in the world of finance. I don't have a grasp on it, but I'm imagining they are not teaching evolution of thought and a revolutionary self-criticism from the level of like curriculum. So, and what I imagine they're teaching in those programs are the very same things that they probably taught when you were going through the program, Ernesto. Where they're injecting professionals into a line of work without any sort of shift in philosophical foundation. So when we're talking about that, you know, that there is a coming change in the next generation, what is the standardized mass introduction that these individuals are having to this line of thought if it's not a foundational element of their profession? Because I think anybody that goes through a process of evolution at a foundational base level, I can respect that. It's hard to change the core of who you are. Many people don't. Most people don't. But if we have an expectation that an entire industry or an entire cadre of professionals servicing an industry are somehow going to partake on that internal experiment, I mean, I don't know.
And not to pile on, but Andre, I think he's so right, because I just finished reading Donut Economics, and what you find is that economic, like academia in terms of economics, like it does not even attempt to touch the problem of what happens like with the, like after growth, or like, you know, those growth charts that just end like in midair. there's no attempt to address, like, wait a minute, you can't like actually grow infinitely. Like it's an exponential curve. Like, hold on. The fact that there's such a gaping hole there, and nobody or almost no one in economics seems interested, and they're going about their business as if, you know, everything's fine. You know, it's like the meme of the
dog,
you know, the dog in the burning building. Everything's just fine. Like, it's like, wait a minute. Like, this is the most obvious problem, and it's not even not only is it not like there's not even a discussion of it, let alone trying to find a solution, which is very difficult, right? The entire economy is based on this growth imperative, you know, and all the fossil fuel usage, material usage, 99% correlated with GDP. Like you have to undermine the entire foundation of the system to get away from this.
Which, if we're talking about a revolutionary shift, let's talk about a revolutionary shift. But
you know what brings some clarity to this is the Bill Sharpe's three horizon framework, where you have a horizon one that is business as usual, status quo, that is collapsing exponentially.
Okay.
But it's trying to be as radical as possible in order to maintain itself. It defines sustainability as the sustainability of that model.
Yes.
When we talk about sustainability, everybody wants to sustain the old model. And that model, we are beyond sustainability. I think, and if you look at that curve, in every sense, it's collapsing exponentially. Exponentiality at its best. If you look at all the anthropogenic curves in the world, they are all in the vertical of exponential growth. All of them. Just put exponential era in the internet and you get a number of graphs. But at the same time, you have the emergent of Horizon 3 that is completely disaggregated. You know, it's the leaves in the underlying canopy that are emerging, like the rhizoma, you know, the bamboo effect. It takes 5 years for the bamboo effect unseen under the earth, and then it sprouts into existence. And you actually can see with your eyes how a rhizome of a bamboo grows. It's probably the only vegetation that you can see with your own eyes, the growth of that. And that is happening. What is happening is the meta crisis is in the horizon two. And that is where innovation occurs. And it's between horizon three, that is the future we want, and horizon one, the status quo, the Harvard University training that brings guys into Armani suits and suspenders like me. I was an agriculture engineer and I came out with an Armani suit, suspenders, and a power tie, you know.
Because you wanted to, I mean, ultimately speaking, if you are an individual going through that program, everybody wants to go through the stage of wearing the proverbial Armani suit. I mean, I think that's a symptom of the problem. And I think that's where it's an interesting arrangement where we're asking the proverbial new generation not to don the Armani suit. But if everybody before them did the same thing, I'll put on the Armani suit 10 years. After 10 years, I'll talk to you about sustainability, but I want to make my cake first.
Yeah. But now you have alternatives. You have the Regenesis, the group Regenesis Practitioners Program. You have the Fullerton course on regenerative economics. You have Nora Bateson's course on warm data. You have Daniel Christian Wall's regenerative cultures. There are different ways of learning that are disaggregated. There is a manual to shift your mind. It's build your capacity, build your sense-making capacity, see that we are running into not a black swan. Like Thomas Friedman says, there is a stampede of black elephants coming towards us, and we knew that, and we know that. And how do we avoid that? And that is training your mind to see this complexity from a systemic view, a way that we can regenerate a way through that. And that's not going to any MBA, because the MBA needs to radicalize itself to keep on bringing people that pay tuition of $100,000 a year to be there.
I think the conversations, has been largely focused on the individual. Last, maybe 10, 15 minutes. Let's zoom out a little bit. Let's talk about some of the broader changes, and let's use that three horizons framework as a bit of a guide. So
yeah.
as we're trying to transition into a new system, you know, obviously we need to make maybe smaller, more incremental changes. And, you know, we can debate the urgency of the meta crisis. Well, actually, I don't know how much debate there is. I mean, it's urgent, but let's leave that aside, although it is relevant. If we're talking about some tangible changes we can make to our financial systems, I think, you know, we talk about like carbon taxes, biodiversity credits. You know, you gave the example of the mate business where you're reinvesting to increase biodiversity. That's great. But in terms of these system-wide changes, what do you think would be the best kind of like low-hanging fruit to address?
So we have a carbon credit market of probably $1 trillion. We have a cryptocurrency market of probably $3 trillion with a number of exchanges, $100 billion a year of trading. There are new assets and there are new currencies, and they've been successful. I think we need to, and I take the example of biodiversity. If we are able to create some sort of evolution of a regenerative asset, let's call it living capital, where that living capital creates regenerative flows, not only in natural ecosystems, but local communities. Let's call it a biocultural credit, where you measure the well-being of local communities in a mutualistic symbiotic relationship with nature. And that can be agroforestry, permaculture, regenerative agriculture, where you are creating ecosystem services that are banking 60% of the GDP of the world, as I mentioned. But you're also creating jobs and well-being in local communities that are acupuncture points for bioregions. You're creating resiliency and climate mitigation, and you're creating solid, purposeful local communities.
Maybe I'm not understanding this fully, but it seems like you've got one foot in the door of Horizon 3. Like that does seem a little, maybe there's an intermediary step between even that. You know, we don't have to have three horizons. Maybe there's multiple, five horizons here. But like, do you see what I'm saying? So it does seem like what I was thinking in my head was, okay, like, can we restructure tax policy to really, like, is that not enough of an intermediary step to, like, let's say we got tax policy to properly account for externalities, like a carbon tax, and then you use the carbon tax to, like, say, reinvest in biodiversity or renewables to expedite their efficiency and so on and so forth. Like, are those kind of changes not good enough? And then, like, there's another thing I read, and it was from your colleague, John Fullerton. He had this idea of evergreen direct investing, which it took away, like, this model of, you know, shareholders getting paid out through dividends to just sharing income stream with investors. So they don't have, I guess, a say in the company. They don't have a say in the direction. They just, you know, they invest like a one-time investment, and then they get whatever income it is, and they can't tell the company that it has to grow exponentially and provide greater and greater returns. Like, those kind of ideas are what I see as more of a transition at this point in time, because it's kind of like you're still in the existing system. You haven't upended it, but you're trying to like rotate it a little bit to make those future, you know, ideas like the biodiversity or the biocultural credits
feasible or
more feasible. Yeah. Because at this point in time, it just seems like it still seems like a bit of a U-turn.
It's a combination of things, as you said. This is this multipolar levers. Look, I'm going back to this Kunming-Montreal agreement where we need to stop the loss of biodiversity and increase biodiversity. That triggered a law in the UK where it's called the BNG, Biodiversity Net Gains. Any new real estate development needs to increase 10% biodiversity of the land that they're working on. That is impossible if you're building a golf course. You're destroying native ecosystems. Mm-hmm. But you have the possibility of investing in offsets. So now you have biodiversity credits. So there's you see the pressure of policy and the pressure of compliance to corporations, right? If you look at the budget needed to stop the loss of biodiversity, and this is official data by the World Economic Forum, it's the gap is $844 billion a year from here to 2030. So it's $5 trillion that need to be migrated into restoring biodiversity. And I think the click is if we are able to open the dam of finance into investing in biodiversity credits as they invested in carbon credits, voluntary and obliged, because compliance is coming that way very, very fast, we are fine-tuning finance into finding a new capital. We've invested how many trillion dollars in cryptocurrencies, in NFTs, in dog-related cryptocurrencies? Why wouldn't we invest in living capital that is providing ecosystem services to sustain 60% of the GDP of the world?
Well, it's because of, you know, how much can you individually profit from it, right? It goes back to like the self-interest.
And I think that's kind of, Ernesto, do you ever feel that what we're discussing is asking the industry, which has wreaked possibly the most havoc on our planet, to itself then generate the solution to save it? I mean, to be blunt, this is not intended to, this question is not intended to be offensive, but do you ever just feel that the only solution is to tear it all down? Is just to, embrace the fact that this is by nature an industry that is destructive, and its single unitary focus of profit will never be able to be harnessed for any form of good. Is there any part of you that has considered the fact that this is like the solution might be to destroy and try to rebuild? And there is no right answer to this. And I'm not trying to imply there's a right answer. I'm just genuinely curious because you've seen the inside. You've worn the proverbial Armani suit. You've gone through a level of intellectual, spiritual, whatever you call it, evolution. Is there a part of you that looks at this and says it's impossible to change? That we can put as many agreements into place, we can generate as many incentives for the industry to evolve, but at the end of the day, it is rotten and it cannot be cured?
That is a true statement. And we are seeing Horizon 1 just collapsing. But there is hope, because this capitalism is something that we invented with our minds. there was something before that that demanded care, that demanded engagement, caring of others, caring of nature.
Mm-hmm.
This is, we were not born with that mind. That mind is, if Nick Higgins calls the carbon pulse, I would call it the something mind pulse. We're mm-hmm. going to look back centuries from now, and we'll have the carbon pulse, and we have the separation pulse
mm-hmm.
in humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And in my transition to understand this, I had very dark years. Now I'm optimistic. We're going to make it. What I cannot define is what civilization is going to be out there that's going to make it. Because this question is are there going to be humans 1,000 years from now? The answer for me is yes. And a completely different version.
Just as we are different from humans 1,000 years preceding us.
Yes, probably a lot fewer. I went to a number of gatherings at the Talbot Forum, and the discussion is, how many humans are going to survive this century? And the number was between 50,000 and 2 billion. But that is our destiny, you know? So I believe the solution.
Everyone thought 6 billion people would definitely die.
Oh my God.
It's interesting. I mean, yeah. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just...
Imagine a world with 4 centigrades increase during this temperature in this century, with the Amazon a savanna and the conveyor belt of the currents stopping. And I wrote my first book called Sustainability 2.0 in 2006.
Mm.
It's nearly 20 years ago. How this Web 3.0, 2.0 at that time was going to change our consciousness. And I've been sensing these changes for over 20 years. The change in our consciousness is also exponential. It's happening. We are not able to see it because it's disaggregated, but also because our minds are linear, cause-effect, reptile. We are shifting between this duality and of two different paradigms. It's like a fish in the water. I cannot explain to you as fishes what the water is because you wouldn't understand it. You're immersed in water, you wouldn't understand it. But you have the capacity of jumping out of the water as a dolphin and see the other dimension. And what is happening now is we are starting to jump out of the water and seeing the other paradigm. And eventually we'll be able to evolve into flying fish or something like that, that mm-hmm. exist in order to be in both paradigms.
So yes, it seems like what you're saying is, you know, we're approaching probably sooner than later in your mind, a threshold where all the fruits of this disaggregated, you know, evolution of consciousness towards a more sustainable and movement and like vision of human life, that like once we pass that threshold, you will actually see the fruits, like the bamboo, grow like exponentially. Yeah. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah. We've seen this paradigm shift in the past. The Copernicus shift took 100 years to be shift our minds. We thought we were the center of the universe. Even Aristotle thought that.
Some of us still think that.
Yeah.
Yeah. This shift is going to be very painful and very fast.
Okay.
And I suppose that is a good anchor point, is that we have had radical shifts in our own perceptions of reality. I think that's a fair statement. I think it's something that we do take for granted, is that the ways in which we perceive the world and we understand the world today, of course, and maybe that's a very like individualistic thing to say, but yeah, of course that's not reflective of how it was. And there were moments in history when somebody had to sit up and argue that, hey, look, maybe this world isn't flat, or the sun is in fact the center of this.
Speaking of moments in history, you know, while I was doing some research for this episode, I ran across this historical fact that in Japan in the 18th century, they actually had a circular economy. And it was like, I think at the time they had 1 million people. And they had closed off trade.
Completely isolated. Yeah.
Yeah, they were completely isolated. So they had to use their limited resources wisely. And they did. I mean, to the point that farmers would come into town and try to get poop from people to use as fertilizer. So it is possible. I don't know if people today can stomach something like that, you know, collecting their poop and selling it off. But it is going to take a paradigm shift.
Well, economic isolation, it's brought about elements of ingenuity and self-sufficiency. I think one of the main reasons that Brazil has an airline industry, right? Embraer produces, I can't speak to the quality of Embraer, but it probably better than Boeing at this point, given all of the issues. But Brazil has a fully functioning airline industry because at one point the Brazilian economy needed it. And I believe they didn't have access to global markets or the capital to acquire it externally. So they were able to pull together and they created a domestic system for airline production that continues to exist and succeed today. But I don't know if we can ever go to a point where we start economically isolating ourselves again. I mean, the argument against globalization, once you have the Pandora's box open, you can't close off your economic structures. But we do have plenty of evidence, well beyond the example of Japan, that countries, when cut off from the world, will continue to function and continue to, as best as possible, meet the needs of their populations. It's not always pretty, and it's not always successful or lean or sexy, but they will survive. Is it possible to deglobalize, to bring things back to maybe a more isolationist approach? And I think, Ernesto, what you were talking about initially with your example of the yerba mate production, I think that's a phenomenally successful example and a very interesting one. I think the only way that would ever work in the United States, if the United States completely cut itself off from global markets, where, yeah.
Or you had just a global, you know, society altogether. Like that's the two alternate, that's the two options. Right, because if you have a global society, then you just scaled up like the United States, and you know the limits are the planetary boundaries.
Well, you're entering what Nate Higgins describes the great simplification. The great simplification is you're not going to eat bananas from Ecuador, spring water from France. Avocados from Chile. There are going to be some, but they're going to be extremely expensive because the logistics to move that, unless we have other fountains of energy, is going to be prohibited.
I mean, my parents who lived in the Soviet Union, they still tell me stories of one of the best gifts you could get for the winter holidays, for New Year. New Year's is kind of the big celebratory period in the winter as opposed to Christmas. a basket of oranges was seen as like delicacy. Oranges in the wintertime.
Yeah.
You could still get it. And this isn't me arguing for the Soviet system. I'm using it to illustrate an example of how much meaning is even attached to something like that, right? To have a ripe, delicious fruit in the wintertime when you could otherwise never get it. And now I don't even know like the last time that I've marveled at the fact that I get to eat like a fucking orange. You know,
that's funny. My first Christmas gift that I remember was an orange under my pillow.
Yeah. But I mean, that means something, right? That's.
Well, it's funny because, we're talking about like, how can we transition to a new economic system where, we still have like, this kind of quality of life, or, we still think of it in terms of like a high, quality lifestyle in terms of materials, but you don't need nearly as much as you think. I mean, numerous studies on well-being and happiness have shown this. There's studies on hunter-gatherer tribes in Tanzania where their well-being is higher than people in developed countries. Like, I mean, so on and so forth. So this idea of degrowth and the great simplification and everything, like, maybe that is the better way to think about it. It's like, what if we consume less, and what if we need less, and then we have a lot fewer issues to contend with? We don't have the same kind of, trajectory of crossing these planetary boundaries. But although the problem is we already kind of have, and we already have a great population, and we already have these corrupted mindsets. And even if you were to degrow, degrow as a society and decentralize and go back to how things were the way they were before, you still have the same human nature and the same incentive, the same game theoretic incentives to outcompete the other tribe. So, maybe society oscillates throughout the history of humanity. It just keeps, becoming more advanced, collapsing, becoming more advanced. But like, you have to bind human nature to something. And I think the moment you scale society up, there has to be some way to change the rules of the game. Those game, the game theory payouts have to change. And so far, we haven't figured out how to do that at a global scale. We've like sort of figured it out like nationally, but now it's like, that is like the third horizon that you talk about. Like, the third horizon is a new set of rules for a global society so that the incentives make sense to preserve global society and the planet's well-being as well. So that's the billion-dollar question. Quadrillion-dollar question.
But the rules are there. The technology is there. And the will is coming into being. I think if we had the capacity to move 300 years into the future, I think we'll be probably a global commons. But the pain and the darkness to get there, it's yet to come.
Well, I think that's, I do agree with you that is a possibility, but I think what we want to know, I think the takeaway we want from this is, what can we do to land the plane more smoothly, right? Like, because what you're saying is the plane's going to crash in the mountains and
there will be like, survivors.
There will be a few survivors and they'll kind of like repopulate and learn from, and the next time they build the plane's not going to crash. That's what you're kind of saying. What I'm hoping we can get out of today is, can we reduce the casualties on this plane crash? Or can we reduce even the damage of the plane crash where the plane just needs to be repaired as opposed to completely rebuilt?
And as a caveat on that, I think it is the prescription that a future generation, most likely not the generation of Levon and I, that a future generation will have to bear the brunt of this dark time is likely very, very accurate. And to piggyback on what Levon is saying, what can we do to lessen the burden that the future generation will have to carry for the sake of humanity?
Good. We are seeing Horizon One collapsing.
Yes.
But there are tools and disruptions in Horizon Two that can help us redirect Horizon One. It's not that we need to work only on Horizon 3. We need to create the, avoid this plane crash. There's opportunities there for this plane to land more safely in a way. And we need to navigate that. There's incredible Daniel Schnatzenberger keynote with the red background where, and even Nate Hagen says that, go connect with communities, connect with nature. I think that healing process is a butterfly just moving its wings into a metamorphic change in the universe. It starts with us. It starts with your work, bringing these conversations into existence. It starts with sitting and trying to avoid this polarization that social media has created. It's finding a middle ground. It's not judging. It's sitting in a conversation, putting your hand in the knee of a friend and says, look, well, I'm here, let's connect. It's with the mate, it's we share this God with others. It's and conversations that have value. It's giving yourself the permission to be yourself. Because the moment you give yourself the permission to be yourself, you give others the permission to be themselves. So now it's not two subjects, it's about the relationship that we build together. And if you give other the permission to be him or herself, that is it's a healing process. It's building communities. It's the third jewel of Buddhism, the Sangha. What is your Sangha? What is the community you have that you can have thoughtful conversations, looking for solutions, being kind, exercising compassion. And I think that has a universal shift because that is our inner light, our inner spirit, you know? How do you exercise your pure intention? What is your purpose in life? Are you really looking for that? What is the curiosity that builds your capacity and capabilities for change? It's inside. And once you exercise that, the universe exercises that. It just only takes one to make the change.
Yeah. I think, yeah. I mean, creating cultural fertile ground for these ideas to prosper is more or less what you're saying. And yeah, it starts with the individual taking some level of responsibility and looking within. But I think this is a great point to kind of wrap things up. Ernesto, if people want to reach you or find more of your work, where can they go?
It's your chance to plug your work. Yeah.
Just Google me. I'm all over the place.
I'm famous.
Open to conversation. No,
I think this might be our first guest that is like wildly Googleable.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks again, Ernesto.
Yes.
And this is a very interesting conversation. And I think there's always a lot more to discuss.
And we'd love to have you back on in the future. Once, the apocalypse starts, we could beam you in from somewhere like fire pit somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it already started. You know? So, but thank you for your work and from this level of conversation of trying to open minds to see the future. I think that is extremely important and relevant, and you're doing a great job. So thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thanks.